session number 23812, reel 15.
Mr. Doyle, reel 15. We were talking about when you were talking about the Dolgokapathen. I can't pronounce it properly, perhaps. About in 1944, a sort of convalescent type camp, almost compared to the others.
By comparison, it was a convalescent. So I was there for some considerable time, and I met up once again with my friend of Ben Howlett in that camp, and we did no work as such. If there was any duties, it was only light duties to generally tidy up and keep your place tidy and that. But I would say this, that it was a most fortunate thing that I had been moved from the master's yard of Dolgokapathen, because whilst I was at this Dolgokapathen, we heard this terrific noise, and when we looked, there was all these flying fortresses, which we know now as flying fortresses, a whole mass of them, and they circled, which appeared to be at a snail's pace, over our camp, and we wondered if they were going to bomb us, and we looked in wonder at the CNR forces once again in mass, and they then circled our camp quite slowly, and then went off in the direction of Dolgokapathen, where I'd been. And we heard a lot of explosions, and what was happening, they were actually bombing where I'd just come from. And quite a number of chaps there got killed in the camp where I was, because they got nowhere to get. And they bombed it. They bombed the marshal yard, and unfortunately some of the bombs went on the camp. So some of the chaps there got killed. I don't know how many, but that did happen. But I do know that my friend, Ted Brinkley, who I told you was in the camp, he came to Dolgokapathen, so he was there.
Was the diet better?
As I've said, that improved, you know.
All the way through from that
improved, not like you would think that food ought to be, but it was acceptable by comparison, as I've just said. So I was there for some time, and I suppose one could say that nothing much which would have been of interest historically happened in that camp, with the exception that there were, I think the doctors had more medical supplies brought in, possibly. And we did have one or two things then, which the Japs from the Red Cross, that was the second thing that we'd had, just a tin or two of things, not very little by comparison to what evidently had been sent. But so time passed leisurely along in that camp, to the extent of boredom in a way. Eventually, I was told that, because we'd got reasonably fit by comparison of how we'd first gone in. I was to move. So we were then formed into groups, and were marched out of the camp. We got to a place along that railway line which we'd walked along, and there was the bridge there, not the bridge over the River Quay, but a bridge had been blasted down, I assume by our bombers. And the natives had constructed what a sort of slap-happy affair of a bridge, which looked as though it had been made with pieces of rope and a plank in the middle. And 100 of feet below, we could see a running river, which we were told we'd got to cross this bridge with what little gear we'd got, and that to get to the other side. And I remember hanging on for grim death on as we marched along each one, so the bridge started to sway from side to side, and began to even more so as we approached from the middle onwards. So it was quite a heavy journey. But that's beside the point. When we got to the other side, we were then marched along until we eventually came to a river. And I found myself boarding a Chinese junk. And we were put down below in a Chinese junk, which was quite an experience. And we were down, I can't tell you for how long, in this Chinese junk. But eventually, it heaved to, and we found ourselves in Bangkok, back to relative civilization. And we disembarked from the junk onto the quayside, and there were these massive big buildings, which we call warehouses, and which they call godowns. I don't know whether that's a sort of Thai word or what it is. Godowns, they called it. So we were housed at these godowns. For what reason, we had no idea. When we got into the godowns, there was simply plain concrete floors inside. The outer entrances of the godowns had been boarded up. And you could see the natives on the quaysides as I went past through the cracks of the boards. So our sleeping quarters was a concrete floor. Whilst we were in there for a day or two, some of us were formed into working parties, and we were taken into Bangkok on these lorries, and we taken into these petrol dumps where these big barrels of petrol were, and we had to roll them along and into the trees and one thing or another where they were camouflaged, you know. That was the sort of work what we were doing. Outside the warehouse, we had to dig a little tree, and similar to what I've already explained in Prisoner of War Life. Beside that were all these what appeared to be boxes and cases of ammunition. And so we realised we were in a spot, if it was bombed, that we'd probably get blown to pieces. So we were in there for quite a period of time.
This would be still 44 and 45 then?
That was the same year, you know.
Still 44?
Yes, yeah, so 44. The working parties, as I have just explained. Well, one day I saw through the cracks of the boards these natives running. I had been sharpening up one of the table knife to give Colour Sergeant Willie Wiles, from who I have already said I linked up with. He lived at Raiden, next to Southwold, where I live. And he was going blind. Evidently, this, although my sight returned, his sight had been affected. So I'd been trying to give him a shave with this table knife, a dry shaving, you know, by sharpening it on the concrete floor, when I've already said I saw these natives running. I thought, hello, something is going on. When I looked at the end of the warehouse, where there was already a narrow little doorway, I saw the Japanese guards had disappeared, who were guardless. I saw blokes trying to get out of the doorway, cramming to get out. I realised that something was on. So Willie, being nearly blind, I grabbed hold of his arm and I said, come on, Willie, we've got to get out here. Something's happening. So we were the last out. When I got outside and looked up, hearing this noise, I looked up, there was a mass of bombers in the sky. And I said to Willie Wiles, I said, Willie, run like hell. And so I grabbed his arm once again, and we ran up this road to where there was a dried paddy field. It was all dry then. And we laid down because I heard a noise like an express train and realised that was a load of bombs coming down. So we lay down, there was this terrific crashing and banging going on, The Japanese guards were nowhere to be seen, incidentally, and we were all lying about. I can remember the cracks in the paddy because of the concussion of the bombs as they landed. The cracks were coming together and nipping our stomachs with the concussion of the bombs. So when the attack was over, we all stood up, and the Japanese guards appeared, gathered us all up, and marched us back to where we had been. The ammunition and everything outside, and the toilet, and that, the roof had gone off the, off where we were in the warehouse, had disappeared, and the all the excreta and one thing another from the toilets was inside the building. There was all sorts of rubbish in there. And what we hadn't realised, well, in the adjoining warehouse, the night previously, some of our chaps had come and were being housed in there, and they did not know the area like we know. And most unfortunately, some of them, when the bombing went on, managed to get out, only ran into the where the ammunition was and got blown to pieces. We cleaned up what the best as we could, the warehouse which we were in. We cleaned up as best we could and tried to settle in. The Japanese then came along, and evidently there were some unexploded bombs that had been landed along this row of warehouses, and some of us had to go and dig down to where these bombs were.
Did you have a time?
Yeah, I had to go, but we done it in working parties. So we got down so far, and then some of the others went on. I believe that I don't think any of these bombs went off. Actually, it was just rather lucky. I don't know what happened to it, to be quite honest. That was that. Now, I will go along further, because we'll soon be coming to the end of my story, but it will take a little time to relate. But when I came out of that, we had to go and dig some more latrines. When I came out of that warehouse to cross the road to where we would dug these latrines, to my surprise, a white man came along on a bicycle. He'd got a pith helmet on. And I later learned that there were Germans living in Bangkok, because they were allies and whatnot. And as this white man passed, he never looked. He had his head down. And when he passed, he said, "Europe is finished." I thought, what am I listening to? And I thought I was dreaming. And he continued biking further along to the warehouses. So I said to the chap, just come along here. He said, "Europe is finished." So now, perhaps by telling you, Peter, that Europe is finished, you might know what year it is, perhaps.
1945.
All right, thank you very much.
So it would have been 45. Yeah. You'd have been in the Compton,
45. Right. So the news went round like wildfire, you see, that somebody had said that war is finished, that Europe is finished. So that was it. Now, the Japanese decided that once again we were to be moved. So we went to the Marshall Yards in Bangkok, and there we saw the devastation of which our bombers had done. There was all terrific amount of damage done in these Marshall Yards. Where bombs had dropped, great big bomb holes and that sort of thing. And a general overhaul, they had made a jolly good job of the destruction of that Marshall Yard. Anyway, we got onto trains there, and not knowing exactly where we were going, because you're never told anyway. So we got onto these trains once again, into these trucks. But this time we travelled faster than when we did coming up to from Singapore to Thailand.
How did the conditions compare?
Well, on the trucks themselves, there was less numbers to a truck. We'd been given some rice and one thing and other's rations. We stopped every now and again along the line, wherever we were going to.
So it was much better.
It was much better as we went along that line. So that was it. So how long it took us to get to our destination is beyond me and beyond recall. I can't tell you. But eventually we came to a river. The river was the Mekong River. And we disembarked near this river, and were taken across in boats to the other side. We were then put into lorries driven by Japanese, and we travelled a considerable number of miles, and we arrived at a village which was called Ubon, U-B-O-N.
U-B-O-N.
Ubon.
And that was in China?
That was in Thailand.
Sorry, Thailand.
But it was on the borders of Indochina. It's on the border of Indochina. And once again, we had to make camps, as I've told before. We made our own camps, and eventually were put onto working parties. The working parties that we went on consisted of going some distance. We had to walk some distance, and we went into area of lands where we were digging up what appeared to be iron ore. One would know that in England you have such things as open cast coal. To go down a mine, it was open cast. This appeared to be open cast iron ore. We had to dig for it, and we had to load up lorries and that sort of thing. Once again, we used chunkles to clear the earth. We had baskets in which to remove the iron ore that was put onto lorries, and then we went and we had to clear quite an area of ground. And the area of ground, after we had cleared it, we realised that what we were clearing was going to be an airplane strip. Not an airport, but a strip where planes could actually land. So we put down as a base this iron ore that we'd been digging up. They had an old steam engine there, of which some of the natives were also working on it, and they, as we laid down the this substance that we were digging up, so they were flattening it out and levelling it off. This went on for some considerable time, making this airstrip, and all the time we would see many of these Buddhist monks walking past us, never took any notice of us, and we or we of them, and the Japanese never touched them, and they would walk past. Little did we know that what they were going to turn out to be. This I will tell you a bit later on. So that was that. It continued for several months, because as you know, the Japanese war continued for some months after the European War. We merely assumed that what the man had told us was correct, that the European War was finished. We didn't know, we had no means of knowing. And so we worked in similar conditions as on the railway. We had our usual brutal guards and that sort of thing, and we would be marched off to do this. And this was what we were doing all the time. And we marched back to the camp at night, etc., and counted. So that was it. We had in that camp allowed us a little leeway, and we formed our own little concert parties and formed a improvised stage and blokes done their little stints.
What was it like? What do you remember of that? Cause, as we said before, you're interested in that side.
Well, there were chaps who had some ability in as much as singing. We still had some of the instrumentalists with us who could form a little orchestra. They were allowed, and even the Japanese would come and sit down and laugh and clap at some of the antics which went on at the on the stage.
Did you do anything?
I didn't do anything myself. No, I didn't. As I already said, I did used to play in an auction of the violin, but I hadn't got a violin, so that was it. My latter days, I must say, I became a singer, which was nothing to do with the prisoner of war life and that. So this went on. Suddenly, we were told to dig big trenches around the inner part of our camp against the fences. And so we dug these big trenches. We also had to dig big trenches around the air strip. And we thought at the time that these trenches were in the event of our forces attacking, that would be where the Japanese forces would get in. What we hadn't realised that what we were digging was our own graves, because it was after the war had finished that we heard that all prisoners of war were to be exterminated. In other words, we were to be shot or bayoneted, and we would be buried in these trenches and covered up. This, I think, was if our forces had invaded that part of Thailand and that part of the world. What we didn't know was that of the atom bombs. We had no idea of the atom bombs. So when the atom bombs exploded over Japan and the order came through to cease hostilities, the Japanese decided that the war was to finish. The atom bombs was the reason why I'm telling this story at the present time. Otherwise, I would have been put to death with all other prisoners of war, and we would have been buried in those pits that we dug. Now, how did we come to know that the war had finished? Well, we were suddenly given a day off work. Unheard of whilst we were prisoner of war. And we wondered what was going on. We had no idea. And so we kept in our huts, and then we began to try to reason out things, why this was happening. And then one of the sergeants, we didn't have any officers with us in this camp because they'd been taken away from us into separate camps. One of the sergeants, our sergeant, came through and said, "Chaps, I've received a message from the commandant that he wants us to parade outside on the Padang, and he wants to give us a talk." So we thought, well, what's this all about? So we all paraded outside, and by that time we realised that there's just a possibility that he was going to say that the war had finished. So we had agreed between us before ever we went out that if he did say this, that the war had finished, that we are free, we would simply stand there. In no way would we clap, no way would we cheer. We would simply stand there in strict discipline at attention while he was silent, just as though, well, why are you telling this? We knew already, you know. So anyway, out came this little Jap command, I can't remember his name. He got up on this mound, all his guards with him, and he said, "The Great East Asia War has finished," in his pidgin English. "You are free men. You must not leave this camp." They talked in a staccato-like voice. And so we stood there. And he nearly fell off. You could tell that he was completely shocked by what he expected us to do. I think he expected us that we had rushed him and that, you know. That. And instead of that, the sergeant said, shouted, "About turn to your huts." And we went to our huts. Of course, when we got in the, inside the huts, then you can imagine we let ourselves go. The Japanese or Korean guards, when we went outside the huts, we could see them running and getting into a hut. They thought we were coming to attack them, although they'd still got their arms, because we hadn't got arms. Now, back to what I said about the yellow-robed monks that we had seen passing us. Little did we know that some of the yellow-robed monks were connected with our forces around that area. We appeared to be miles and miles away from anywhere. To our most amazement, the next morning, we heard orders being shouted outside the camp, and in the camp came marching an officer. They got their machine guns and one thing or another, you know, and armed, marching into our camp. We couldn't believe what we were seeing. There was us in these little Jap happies. There was these chaps coming in who we couldn't believe that our forces were there. Now, the Japanese, the English officer then addressed us and said that, "Unbeknown to you, no doubt, that we have been round your camp for a considerable length of time. Unbeknown to you, when the Japanese commandant was telling you that the war had finished, unbeknown to you, there were, outside the perimeter of your camp, were Japanese soldiers with machine guns trained on you. And had you reacted in any way, you know, other than probably what you did, they were going to machine gun you. We were behind, unbeknown to them, we were behind them. And had they opened up or done anything like that, we would have chopped the lot," he said. So that was our first experience of any forces being around that area. We were quite amazed. So anyway, they disarmed the guards. They told us to stay in the camp and await further orders. And what we had to put down on the parade square, or padang, a big cross. Mark it off in the soil, and that planes would eventually come along and find us and would drop supplies to us. So we did do this. We put this big cross down on the ground. Eventually, after several days, some American planes came over, and we all got out jumping and waving and cheering as we saw them come over. And then we looked and we saw them dropping supplies away from us, and realised that what they were doing, they had dropped them on Japanese camps, Japanese army camps, our supplies. So for several days, planes coming over us. Eventually, anyway, I suppose, must have got through to them that, what they were doing, because they came over, found us, and we could see the chaps in the back of the plane as they went over, and they dropped these big canisters by parachute, which landed on the padang. And when we opened them, there was all the things that we had missed in life. There were cigarettes, there was all sorts of vitamin cereal types of things, there was food, there was chocolate, there was all the things that we had missed.